Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show here on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Two love stories today. One from reality TV's Little Couple and their book about optimism called Think Big. Part two, another love story closer to home. Husband and wife musicians Jack and Jill, Jack Grassel and Jill Jensen, who performed this weekend with the Choral Arts Society. Stay with us. And what a pleasure it is for me to have on the other end of the telephone today two people I feel like I know, and I bet you feel like you know them also if you happen to watch the reality television program which stars them, The Little Couple on TLC. We're talking about Dr. Jennifer Arnold and Bill Klein, who not only reveal their lives to television viewers on a weekly basis, but also write with such discernment about the lives which they experience as little people. And they have written a new book called Think Big, Overcoming Obstacles with Optimism, in which they speak frankly about some of the ways in which life has been less than easy for both of them, and yet the way in which they've managed to experience all kinds of tremendous joys and successes. And an optimistic spirit has made a huge difference all along the way. And they encourage all of us to live our lives with a bit more optimism as well. The book is published by Howard Books, a division of Simon & Schuster. Again, it's called Think Big, Overcoming Obstacles with Optimism. And Jennifer Arnold and Bill Klein, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Good to be talking with you. I really, really do appreciate it. One of the things I appreciated about your book was that, all of us who know who you are and watch your program know that you are both little people. But your book kind of spells out the reality which both of you have lived with, that is the specific situation that each of you have, something that I think is called spondyloepiphyseal dysplasia, or SED, which is probably what we should call it. But the reason it's worth talking about is because it doesn't just make you little people, but it also, in a sense, sets you on a really arduous gauntlet all your lives, where there's all kinds of things going on besides the fact that you're small. But also there are other things, issues that almost certainly arise that have to be addressed with surgery after surgery after surgery. Until I read your book, I didn't really understand that part of your reality. And in a sense, it makes your optimistic spirit all the more remarkable, doesn't it?
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I think from our perspective, we've just been overwhelmed and very appreciative of all the positive response we've gotten along the way as we've shared our lives. And I think, you know, from our perspective, it's just sort of trying to live our lives as best we can and hopefully helping raise awareness for other individuals like ourselves who might be dealing with challenges or differences or obstacles in their lives.
Bill Klein, at one point in the book, you say, it's sort of posing yourself this question in wonderment, when did I win the Powerball of life? And you're saying that not ironically or sarcastically, but in all sincerity. And yet, of course, a lot of people might experience what you have experienced and not feel like they've won anything at all resembling the Powerball of life. Explain how you can say that. What prompts you to view your life as positively as that?
Well, I guess when I take a look back at the experiences that have brought me to where I'm at today, and all the things that that I've been able to enjoy, I can't help but think that I've been looked upon rather favorably. And everybody faces challenges in life. We're no different. I think that some of our challenges are certainly a little bit more unique than the average. But certainly not necessarily more difficult. I think everybody handles those challenges differently. When it comes down to it, though, despite surgery and such, we've come out fairly unscathed from that perspective. My wife and I got to meet when we had just gotten into our 30s, and we've been together for 10 years now, and that's been an absolute fantastic experience from the moment we met. We've got two wonderful children that they lived in different zip codes would be the easiest way to describe it. They were on different sides of the planet, and each of them are amazing, and they're now doing superiorly well. They're happy, they're fun, they're smart, they're growing, all those things. My wife went through cancer, came out the other side. She smiles every single day. We have successful careers. How could I think of it any other way than to think that I won the lottery?
You are a wise man, and you are absolutely, you have all kinds of things to be grateful for. That is for sure. In just a second, we'll get to the matrix of optimism that you kind of spell out with your motto of Think Big. I want to just talk a moment about the program, because you talk about it in your book, again, which is called Think Big, Overcoming Obstacles with Optimism. You were approached about the possibility of opening up your lives in a reality program after, I think, you, Dr. Arnold, appeared on Good Morning America. And somebody at TLC saw that and thought, boy, this could be the start of something really interesting. At first, you said no to that possibility. You weren't particularly interested in that. And then something happened one day in a supermarket, I think, which prompted you to kind of rethink the answer you had given to that invitation. Just to tell our listeners about that moment. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when they did first approach us, I thought, well, this could be risky, it could be sensational, and, our goal, I think personally, since we have all of our entire lives drawn attention when we're out in public from other people who are curious or, I've never met a little person before, I thought, well, I don't want to sensationalize the fact that we're a little people, and that's not the goal. And so we turned them down, but I happened to be shopping, which is my favorite hobby, and not necessarily grocery stores, but actually,
right.
I think it might have been Bed Bath & Beyond, after all. I was probably shopping for something fun, and a little girl, she probably was about 7 or 8, came up to me, and she said, wow, it's so nice to meet you. You're a little person, like Little People, Big World. Well, and that was a show that had been on, maybe a season or two at most, at that point, about a family, the Roloffs, who have, the parents and one of their kids is short statured. And I knew about the show, obviously, and actually we know their family personally. I thought, oh my goodness, this is amazing. This little girl learned something from that show. And in fact, it was not only was the fact that she had, watched the show and hopefully learned something about little people, but she learned the correct terminology that wasn't, stereotypical. She said little person instead of midget, the M word, which is oftentimes very derogatory for people of short stature. And so the fact that she had taken away from that show something positive, and that, instead of getting pointed at, stared at, laughed at, she was just very frank and matter of fact about, hey, nice to meet you. I thought, okay, maybe this is an opportunity that we shouldn't turn down. Yeah, it might be risky, but maybe, this is an opportunity that maybe we can make a difference too.
I think you certainly have. And of course, I think a lot of us appreciate the fact that the program is so positive and isn't afraid to explore what, in a sense, are just kind of the mundane, ordinary challenges of life as you live them out in your particular way, without trying to stir up a lot of controversy or anything. I think as reality programs go, it's one of the most positive and beneficial that's probably on television right now. Bill Klein, one of you in the book at some point says, we don't view the show as our job, but as a very time-consuming hobby. I wonder if you could just kind of explain what that distinction means to the two of you.
Yeah, my wife came up with that catchy little phrase, but we have day jobs. I run a business. I have a pet store in Houston where we're growing, we're expanding, and all that fun stuff. And so I have employees, and people's livelihoods that I'm responsible for, outside of my own, which is fun and also challenging. My wife is a well-trained physician that teaches hundreds, if not thousands, of people a year in the clinical environment, healthcare world, to take care of critically ill infants. So television is it is a busy hobby. We fit it in where we can. We don't let it interfere with our careers because we worked really hard to get to where we are today. And while there have been some wonderful things that have happened because of our exposure to the world and television and all that fun stuff, this book is one of those things that likely we wouldn't have had the same opportunity, maybe the same story, but not the same opportunity to tell it. We appreciate those things, but at the same time, it's still just a very busy hobby. And, we'll have fun while the show's around. And when the show's gone, there's not much of a transition. Instead, we get to watch the nightly news when we want to, and we don't have to DVR everything on the weekend.
Very good. The title of the book, Think Big, actually stands for kind of this, as I called it, a matrix or framework of different tenets of your sort of philosophy of living optimistically. T is for try, H is for hope, I is for initiate, N is for no, as in never listen to the no's, K is for no, K-N-O-W, as in know your limitations, B for believe, I for improve, G for go for it. And then through the course of your book, you talk about these different facets of optimism and the ways in which you have lived them out through the course of your life and through the various challenges that you have had to contend. Certainly one of the predominant themes in the book is the incredible joy which your two children, Will and Zoe, give to you each and every single day. And we get a sense that the two of you are learning even more about living optimistically as you live the lives of parents and also as you see your own two children contending with the same challenges that confronted both of you when you were their age. Talk more about the way in which being parents to these two children, wonderful children, have sort of clarified some of what you write about in this book.
Doc?
Oh, okay. So from, I guess, to start off, and I know my husband can say this much more eloquently than I can, for our kids have just opened our eyes to, life, really. Everything we do, we enjoy so much more because of them. And now that we've been reflecting sort of on our lives and how our parents raised us, to be strong and independent and to achieve our goals, that's what we want to, there's nothing more important than trying to instill that in our children. And so I would say it all starts with our parents, that we were so fortunate to have been, I am home with two loud dogs, to be independent and happy. And because our parents did that for us, there's nothing more important to us than doing that for our kids. And we just know that our kids are going to continue to exceed and excel and show us, more lessons than we could ever teach them. But they're just the best kids we could ever ask for.
Hmm. Bill Klein, one of the most beautiful moments in the book is also something that comes when you're talking about when you and Zoe had trouble connecting. That is, she seemed very suspicious of you. She bonded immediately with your wife, but there was a barrier there. She was so suspicious of you, and you had to really be tenacious in your love for her. Of course, now that seems like probably a century ago that there were those issues between you and your brand new daughter.
Yeah, it was a tough couple of months there. I am surprised that I still have a full head of hair, albeit turning gray rapidly. When we first got home, my daughter was having a tough time adjusting. And what's interesting is that in all of the books that you read, the experts you speak with, the people that you work with to help complete the adoption process, they all tell you that what we were about to experience is common. We didn't experience that at all with William because he's an enigma also. And he was happy from about the moment we met him, and never really looked back. There was no challenge with him accepting us as, you know, as his parents and into his life. Zoe was more typical, and it's not to say that she was atypically more, you know, pessimistic or negative, but rather she was just being a two-year-old girl that was taken away from everything she knew and thrust into a situation where, you know, the primary caregiver was this fuzzy, four-foot-tall man that has very little clue about how to parent. And that's what she had to rely on. So I can understand her. She was disconcerted. Mm. But yeah, that was how it started off. Mm. And tenacity, I think, is something that you know, it's part of the process. It's understanding that you can't blame yourself for the circumstances that you might be involved in, but rather that, you know, you have no choice but to get through it. And to be optimistic and to be positive and to smile, and even if you're being stared at and facing adversity, that you have to look back with a smile.
Mm. Well, it's a tremendous story for both of you, not only of the adoption of these two wonderful children, but Dr. Arnold, your courageous battle with cancer, which you have surmounted, we are so happy to say, and life goes on for your growing family. And you talk about all of this in your new book, Think Big, Overcoming Obstacles with Optimism. Dr. Jennifer Arnold and Bill Klein, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and congrats on all that you've accomplished, and best wishes with all that is ahead.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
Bye-bye. And the time is 8:26. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD. Your gateway to public radio, and here's part two.
When I was young, I dreamed of fame and fortune. Walked the city, head high in the sky. Youthful and naive, I would make believe I was on the stage and playing the saxophone. And then I'd be hanging out with all my heroes. I was the hottest new face on the scene. And in the sharpest threads, I'd be turning heads. They'd be hungry for the secret of my success. By the time I'd finally arrived, things had changed. And all the faces had suddenly disappeared from the places that didn't close down. My street of dreams made way for modern living, and here it'd been buried by concrete and stone. And though it's not the same, I guess I can't complain, 'cause the music goes on living without a doubt. And the news is it will never be chased out.
Is the magical guitar playing of Jack Grassel and the wonderful singing of Jill Jensen, and together we know them as Jack and Jill Jazz, and they are two treasures here in southeastern Wisconsin. I'm sure many of you know of their artistry well, and a very special opportunity is coming up to enjoy their artistry as they collaborate this weekend in a concert with the Choral Arts Society under the direction of Jim Schatzman. Of course, the Choral Arts Society spends most of their time singing Mozart and other, you know, music of great choral composers from down through the ages, but they love to include in each and every season a collaboration with somebody who sort of takes them into a different realm of music. And this promises to be a very, very special night indeed. And I'm really happy for this opportunity to welcome Jack and Jill to The Morning Show. And those of you who listen to the Midday Report know also that Dave McGrath, by complete coincidence, is featuring their wonderful music making each and every day during Midday. So this is a big week for WGTD as far as Jill Jensen and Jack Grassel are concerned. We welcome both of you to The Morning Show. I'm delighted you can be here.
Well, thank Thank you, Greg. How about a big radio blush for the audience? That was so such glowing praise.
Well, I've been admirers of you for a long, long time, and I am so happy that we have this opportunity to finally talk about your careers and also the special relationship that you have had for all these many years. You each had interesting and flourishing lives as musicians even before you met, of course, and became your duo on and off the stage. But let's begin with each of your stories in terms of where you come from and what you did before you connected with the other. Jack, I understand that you are born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and music was an enormous part of your life from just about the very beginning.
When I was 2 years old and learned how to walk, I walked up to my mother's piano, and I reached my hands over my head and play the piano. And I'd play with the radio that was on all the time. And then when I was 3 years old, my dad took me to the music store and said, "Is there something this little guy can play with his little fingers?" And they had a miniature accordion, which they gave me, and it was very small, and it fit me perfectly, and I learned how to play it, and I took to it quickly. And then my Aunt Adeline had a vaudeville show, and she put me on her show playing the accordion when I was 4 years old.
4 years old.
They dressed me up like a cowboy, and I would play the hit songs of the day, like Cool Cool Water was a hit in whatever year that was, 1953. And then I got older and played the accordion for weddings and parties and baptisms, and I was making good money playing the accordion. But when I was 12 years old, my friends in seventh grade said if I got a bass, I could play in their rock and roll band. So I did, and I started to play rock and roll two nights a week. And I made a lot of money doing that as a seventh grader while my friends had paper routes. I was playing gigs. And then in high school, I was playing every night of the week with an R&B band. And then I switched to guitar in my 20s, and I've been playing guitar ever since. And it's over 3,000 gigs now.
Wow. I'm just curious, in those years growing up of junior high and high school and so on, was your music making entirely extracurricular outside of school? Or were you, or did your music making also involve playing in the band or singing in the choir, anything like that?
No, at that time they did not use guitar or electric bass in the school bands, and they only played classical music. And so jazz or the music I was playing at the time, rhythm and blues or rock, was not played in school. So there was no place for me in school. So I was playing in the bars every night in high school, and I could hardly stay awake during school. And I missed my high school education. I wasn't mentally present, but I was playing every night of the week, and I had this exciting life playing every night. And I had a nice car, you know, as a high school kid, and it was really an exciting time.
So tell us when guitar sort of ended up seizing the sort of center stage for you, where that became more your primary focus, and if that was a very conscious decision on your part, that at least for a while that was going to be kind of your main creative outlet.
Well, in 1970, when I decided I was no longer interested in playing the electric bass, I had heard jazz music, and I said, well, I need to play a different instrument because the electric bass is not featured in jazz music, which is the music I wanted to play. And Jaco Pastorius had not yet liberated the electric bass and said this can be a jazz instrument. So I thought if I'm going to play jazz, I'll play it on guitar. So I got a guitar and learned how to play that, and I studied with the best teachers I could find. Many times I would get in my car and drive to New Jersey for my guitar lessons, and it would take me 16 hours to drive to my guitar lesson.
Wow. So you fell in love with jazz first.
Oh, yes.
And then...
And I needed the appropriate instrument to play jazz on.
Now, that's not a story you hear very often, that you're led into the one because of your love of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Tell us just about the falling in love with jazz. Did that happen overnight and in any particular way?
Oh, no. I was going to school in Madison. I decided to give up music at one point when I was about 20, and I was in pharmacy school, which did not work out very well at all. I was not interested in that. And I was walking to my pharmacy class, and I walked by a music store or a record store, and the door was open. I heard this crazy music coming out of the door. So I walked in, and I said to the clerk, Mitch Kovic was his name, I said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's jazz." And I skipped my classes, and I hung around in this record store, and he would give me an education. He'd play records for me. And finally, one day my mother had given me $30 to buy food for the week, and I went to the record store, and they had a cutout bin of monophonic records, which were $2 a piece. So I spent my $30 and bought 15 LPs, jazz records,
and I had
the clerk pick them out for me because I didn't know what to get. And so he gave me these fine records, and I put my $15 on the counter. I went home, and all I did was listen to these records, and I dropped out of pharmacy school and decided I'm going to be a jazz guitar player.
Wow, that's exactly what you
did. That was it.
Wow, that's quite an amazing story. And as an opera fan, I have to ask you about one of all kinds of impressive things that are on your resume in these decades that you've performed. It's not every day that you meet someone who's actually been on stage with Luciano Pavarotti. So,
well, I was at home practicing like any other day in the morning, and the phone rang. And I said, "Well, I'm not going to answer the phone because I'm practicing." And then it kept ringing, and they kept calling back. And I thought, okay, I'll answer it. So I picked up the phone, and the guy says, "You busy today?" And I says, "Yeah, I'm going to stay home and practicing." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, Luch," meaning Luciano Pavarotti. It was his manager. He called him Luch. He said, "Well, Luch wants to do duets with a guitar player tonight on his concert for 10,000 people at the Bradley Center. Are you available?"
Whoa.
And I said, "I think so." And so I went down to the Bradley Center, and here comes Luch. His driver drove him up in a green Mercedes, and he had a big scarf around his neck, keeping his neck warm, and Luch did not talk. He whispered to his manager, and his manager would tell me what Luch said. So it was just me and Luch and his manager in this room, and I got to hear Pavarotti's voice coming out of his mouth, not through a microphone, not on a record, not through a radio,
right?
Which was exciting. He was facing me about 2 feet away from me, aiming his mouth towards me, and I got to hear this sound coming out of his mouth. And I played a classical guitar, and we did tunes in front of this audience at the concert at night. It was pretty exciting, just him and me.
Oh, my gosh. I can't imagine what a thrill. I'm surprised your fingers worked, under those circumstances.
And now I play with a better singer. I play with Jill Jensen.
Of course
now.
You do. And that's who we need to meet next. From Pavarotti to Jill Jensen. Jill Jensen, a proud born and raised native of Racine, right?
Absolutely.
So when did singing start to become such an important part of your life? At the age of 3?
Boy, anything I'm going to say is going to pale after anything he said. But, everybody has a skill set.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know what your children are going to be when they grow up, watch how they play.
Mm.
And my favorite thing was when I was a year old, I got a record player, and I played every record, and I listened to all the music and the radio. I had to have music all the time. And Jack recently, when we had moved, found my baby book and said, my first sentence, which I had not read this baby book, my first sentence was, "Where's the music?" 3 words. And then later on, the second sentence was, "See my pretty dress." And he said, "You are just taller." So what my mother had written, and she's long since passed away, was that my favorite thing to do was to sit and sing and play my records all day long, and that when people came over, I would make them sit quietly and listen to me. I'd get upset if they weren't paying attention. I wanted them to clap by all of these things, and I thought, oh, my goodness. But that was it. And then in school, you don't think anything of yourself. The teachers decide that you're to get solos, and the teachers put you in choirs. And I was chosen for the very first all-city choir that they had back then with Marcella O'Leary and so forth. And so I was bussed all over town to go to all-city choir. Met people who are still my friends. And from there, it seemed like people saw something in me I didn't even see in myself. They would come and get me and say, "We want you in our band. We want you in our show. We want you in our play. We want you to audition for this. We want you to do these things. We want you to make this commercial. We'd like you to speak this song. We'd like you to do this part." And so it was like, okay. So apparently, these things were seen in me and taken and cultivated.
And you're saying people were seeing aspects of yourself, abilities, potential that you didn't even fully realize was there.
No, it's just what I would do.
Right.
You know, in your report cards, I never thought that, at the actress part of me, I never thought that reads with expression would lead to, you know, a part of my career.
Yeah.
I didn't think, you know, that my music grade, and it wasn't thought of back then that if you were doing things with fine arts, that it was employable. I was discouraged from this as a young lady who was supposed to be maybe a teacher or a secretary or a mommy. So you always, a woman at that time, had to think in terms of something else that would be lucrative or acceptable.
Right.
So it was always an avocation instead of a vocation until Jack.
Right. Now, tell me about how the two of you met.
She came into the Yardarm in Racine. That's a bar in Racine. And she came in with her boyfriend at the time, who was one of my students.
Ah, okay.
he dragged her down to hear me play. He said,
"So,
Jill,
guitar student."
Yeah, mm-hmm. He said, "Jill, come and see my guitar teacher."
He's awesome.
Mm.
So you know, they came down, and Jill and I met, and sparks flew between our eyes, and the room started moving around, and I got dizzy just looking at her. And then I invited her about 6 months later to accompany me to the National Guitar Workshop on the East Coast, where I was teaching at the time. And she came along with me, and Keith Richards always says, before you have a relationship with somebody, go on a car trip with them.
Mm.
So we had this wonderful time talking in the 16 hours on the way out to the East Coast and back in my car. And we fell in love, and I accompanied her on her recital because she enrolled as a student at that school I was teaching at.
Yeah.
And we played one song, and we looked at each other, and we thought, wow, we can do this. And so we decided that's what we were going to do.
Now, I remember reading on the biography on your website. Your website's terrific, by the way. It says something that implies that when you first got together, you didn't think much about making music together or keeping music kind of separate. Do I remember that correctly?
Absolutely. I didn't want him to hear me. Hmm. He was like the famous guy that I had heard of and had gone to see, and I didn't want him to hear me or see me.
Little
and
old
I,
you.
And I was afraid that it would interfere with the relationship. So at that point, my focus was on developing this relationship, getting to know each other, and not putting this music together. It was the furthest thing from my mind that he would ever hear me.
Hmm.
And then I was be afraid, too, that he might have to feel like he would have to say something nice. I didn't want to put him in that spot. And so at least 6 months went by before he even heard me sing, other than maybe at the grocery store.
And was that first time preparing for this recital where he accompanied you?
Yes.
Wow.
Pretty much.
And
then after that, he might have heard me do some Penguin shows, and that was the solidifying factor, was doing that. And he said, we can do this.
Wow.
And since then, I've talked to numerous couples that make music together as a duo, and we all seem to agree that a special thing happens when you make music with the person you're in love with and the person you live with. There's an extra something that coats the music, an extra electricity or something. When I play with other people I'm not in love with, yes, I try to do my best all the time. But when I play with Jill, there's an extra something that happens that coats the notes I play. I'm just glued to everything she does. I'm with her all day. So I'm attuned to her body English, and I know when she doesn't like something I play or when she does. And I'm that attuned to everything about her that I play my best when I play with Jill, and she sings her best when she sings with me. And together, the music goes to a much higher level than if we were not married and in love with each other. It makes extra special music, and other couples I've talked to agree with that.
And I also don't want him to, I want him to be proud of me, you know, so I'm probably at my best making music. I mean, of course, everybody ascribes to trying to be their best at all times, but however, when it's with him. Now, on one of our recent albums that we had sent out to a jazz historian, Scott Yano, even listening to it without seeing us, we always hear this. We always hear about the special something, how fun it is to watch the interplay of two people in love. And he without having really seen us, wrote, you know, there's the magical chemistry, the telepathic interplay of two people who are in love. So apparently, you know, that comes off, that, you know, creates that tightness that, you know, even that in jazz doesn't always exist because it's so improvisational.
Right.
So maybe our connection to each other on a larger level leads to more of a tightness within the quality of our music.
And you seem to be saying that it was like that right from the start, that, I mean, from that very first recital where he accompanied you, you felt that powerful connection.
Instantly, I realized there's something different here that I haven't felt before.
By the way, what were those first songs where Jack accompanied you? Do you happen to recall?
We did one song. We did Moonlight in Vermont.
Oh, just one. Yeah. Oh.
Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
It was an international guitar workshop, and he was the artist in residence for that week. And so the class that I took was jazz singing. It was one other girl. I mean, it was a guitar camp, and she was 14, and she wanted to do Killing Me Softly in reggae. So Jack was able to rearrange it for us. So he accompanied us doing Killing Me Softly in reggae.
Oh, for goodness.
And then it was he and I doing the other, because the faculty wanted he and I to do a song. We made such good friends, and we were clowning around, goofing with all these guys and women. And they said, well, we think the two of you ought to do something. Grudgingly, we did this.
Well, it sounds like they were right.
They were right.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on the morning show with Jack and Jill, namely Jill Jensen and Jack Grassel. And they are collaborating this weekend with the Choral Arts Society with their director, Jim Schatzman. And before we talk kind of about what that concert is going to be offering up, let's listen to a song that is going to be featured on that. We should say that the very first music that we listened to at the top of the show, Chased Out, was from a CD called Live at the Carlton Grange Pub, where you used to play the Sunday brunch. This particular performance comes from the CD called Jack and Jill Jazz. And tell us about this song called Take Five.
This came out in, I believe, 1957. Paul Desmond wrote this. And this was at a time when jazz was featured on the radio, AM radio, at the same time rock and roll was, and country music and classical music. All this stuff was in the blender. It's not all specialized the way it is now. So you could hear a jazz song, a rock song, a classical song, and a country song all back to back. It was an exciting time. So this was a pop song in 1957 that Paul Desmond wrote, and most music that people play has four beats to the measure. So it's 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4. Paul Desmond wrote this song, and he added an extra beat. So now it was 1-2-3-4-5, 1-2-3-4-5, 1-2-3-4-5. And it took a long time for the rest of the world to figure out how to add an extra beat to the measure. So historically, this is a very important song.
What is my involvement in it is that most people recall this song as an instrumental. The most famous player of Take Five is Dave Brubeck.
Oh, yeah, right.
So very few people get to hear words that were written, lyrics that were written by Dave and Iola Brubeck. So Dave and his wife wrote the lyrics to accompany the song Take Five, and they're rarely heard. So it's going to be a great pleasure to perform them at this concert.
And here it is right now, Take Five with Jack and Jill.
Won't you stop and take a little time out with me? Just take five, just take five. Stop your busy day and take the time out to see. I'm alive, I'm alive. Though I'm going out of my way just so I can pass by each day. Not a single word do we say. It's a pantomime and not a place. Still I know all eyes are for me. I feel tingles down to my feet. When your smile gets much too discreet, sends me on my way. Wouldn't it be better not to be so polite? You could offer a bite. Start a little conversation now, it's alright. Just take five, just take five.
That is such wonderful music making by husband and wife team of Jack and Jill, Jack Russell and Jill Jensen. This is off of their CD called Jack and Jill Jazz, and that's really how they're known now as they perform together, and typically the twosome. And you were talking before we went on the air about how there are ways in which performing as a duo is almost more exciting than when you have a stage full of musicians joining you, because there are certain things that probably happen when it is just the two of you that that can't maybe happen on a crowded stage.
Well, it's a conversation between two people. Imagine a symphony orchestra. If everybody put down their instruments and started to talk with each other, you'd have 60 people talking to each other. You know, it's an inefficient conversation, whereas with two people, it's very efficient. Because you have two listeners, one person's talking while the other person's listening. And so playing music like that allows the music to evolve to a very high level, I think. Sometimes it fails, but usually it's a very high level.
Well, and it's a playful level. Because you're not having to be so cognizant of everything else that's going on with everybody else and listening. You have to listen so much when you're making music and not just sending it out.
Right, right.
You're responding to somebody else's music. You're listening to it.
It's particularly in jazz.
Absolutely, absolutely. And very quickly, people say, I like to act and I don't get the opportunity and I love lyrics. And so for me to be able to sing, it's like delivering one-act plays.
What a nice way to put it. And you were saying before we went on the air that you just love to be next to your husband as he picks up one instrument after another and displays this remarkable mastery over all of them.
I like watching people
watch him. Say that again?
I like watching people watch him.
Huh.
Because they're not expecting all of this. They're always looking for something else. And he is playing all of those instruments. So it's not like it's pre-recorded. It's not like it's some device or something. It's him.
Jack, I know you don't want to dwell on this too much because it was not a happy time in your life, but there was a time a little over a decade ago when you actually were physically, medically unable to play guitar for a while and in a sense had to kind of rebuild your technique, which needless to say you've done in spectacular fashion. I just wonder if you would mind saying just a word about that process by which you first could take up the guitar again and sort of what that felt like and how you navigated sort of, I kind of relearning and rebuilding this technique, which probably to some extent you'd taken for granted all those years when it came so easily and naturally?
That's a good question. I was spending a lot of time in the hospital in bed. I was bedridden for a long time. And all I could do was, well, my brain worked. The rest of my body did not work. Some people would disagree with that. But all I could do was play music in my head all day and think all day. I couldn't move. And I was bedridden pretty much for about 6 months. So I lost all my health. I lost my all ability to play. And when I finally got out of bed and I tried to rebuild my health, I had forgotten everything I knew about music. And I had to decide, first of all, if I wanted to play music again. And I did decide, yes, I will try to do this. There's nothing else I want to do. So I got to start from scratch. I made a list of what were the things I do not like about my playing and what I really play like in my dreams. What do I want to sound like? And I began to write out the appropriate exercises for myself so I could develop that. And I got on this amazing practicing routine. Some days I would practice all day, you know, like 15 hours.
Wow.
I would practice. And then I decided to be a multi-instrumentalist. I had accrued all these skills over the years on other instruments, so I thought, what? Why not play all of them again?
Instead of just during the symphony.
So on my latest CD, I play 11 instruments on there.
Wow.
And it's real interesting. When I get tired of practicing the guitar, I'll go play the mandolin, or I'll play the bass, or I'll practice singing. And it makes for efficient practicing all day. Whenever my mind starts to wander, I'll go practice a different instrument.
Wow. That's quite a life. And Jill, you had a great phrase. I can't remember what it is now, but this phrase, you said some kind of phrase about what your husband went through in terms of reshaping, rebuilding his technique. Something about closets. I can't.
Oh, it was his words. I was just simply quoting him when he was saying that, you know, there's good in everything, no matter how dreadful that illness was. It gave him an opportunity to clean out his cliche closet. As a musician, you know, people know what that means. He no longer depended upon doing a similar thing repeatedly. He was allowed to, he had the time to come up with something new all the time in his improvising skills.
Yeah, wonderful.
Well, the difference between a mediocre and a good jazz musician is, a jazz musician is supposed to create and compose on the spot and perform the music. And a lot of jazz musicians, including myself, rely on cliches, things that we're comfortable with that we play over and over again in different settings. The better jazz players don't rely on cliches, like Lee Konitz, for example. Every time he picks up his horn, it's something new. So I was trying to clean out all this old stuff I had been playing over and over again and try to play new things.
Well, and the rest is history. I mean, that becomes one of the things that we love most about what you two do. And, of course, speaking of something new, you have this wonderful collaboration now that will happen with the Choral Arts Society on Saturday night. And new for them, new for you, and new for all of your fans to hear you in kind of a different venue in collaboration with this wonderful choral group. That's going to be so much fun.
I'm even going to play accordion that night.
Oh, for old time's sake. Very good. And that's a heavy instrument, so it's good exercise. So this is Saturday night, the 7th of May, at EAA Chapter 838, 333333 North Green Bay Road. That's essentially right beside the airport, the Racine Airport.
It's a hangar. Yeah. It's in a museum and a hangar, a big facility.
I sang there when they did something called the Defiant Verdi Requiem. That happened to be in that same space. It was a neat place to make music, and I know it will be a perfect venue for what's going to be happening Saturday night, 7 p.m. And you can go to the Choral Arts website, choralartsonline.org, if you want more information. And if you want more information about what Jack and Jill do, go to jackandjilljazz.com. That is their website. Here's a little taste of Jack and Jill as we go out with Beyond the Sea. Jack Grassel, Jill Jensen, what a great pleasure to have you on the morning show today, and very best wishes with all the music making in your future.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.